Yes, I knew, Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move with the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely.
I'll never forget it.
Welcome to Adventist Voices, Spectrum's podcast. I'm Alexander Carpenter, and we're continuing our series from last week on the political situation in the United States of America. As probably everyone knows, we have an election coming up, and beyond the presidential choices, there are quite a few issues at play up and down the ballot, depending on where you're at. And it really does seem like it's a pivotal moment in our nation's history. And for folks who live outside the United States, it does seem like the issues that are at play here have echoes around the globe. I am joined by two outstanding scholars. I'd like to introduce Dr. Vanessa Corradera, Chair of the English Department at Andrews University. Welcome, Dr. Corradera.
My pleasure.
And I would like to also introduce Dr. Courtney Ray, who is the president of the Society for Black Neuropsychology and also an ordained minister in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Welcome, Dr. Ray.
You're welcome.
So we have an election coming up. So I think the first thing I'd really like to hear from both of you is what's kind of keeping you up at night, or what sort of issues jump out at you when you're paying attention to the news? What is really, you know, of concern to you as a citizen and as an Adventist?
Well, one of the things I can tell you that keeps me up at night is, as a citizen, just some of the blatant disregard for human rights and equality that I see, not just in the local level, because, you know, we have seen a lot of brutality and injustice in our policing system and our judicial system, but even in the higher echelons of government, just, you know, lots of different things in inequality in terms of gender inequality, inequality for different people from different backgrounds, sexuality, immigration, all those kinds of things. And what keeps me up as an Adventist is the fact that many of our Adventist brothers and sisters kind of don't care. Or
yeah,
they are willing to overlook it for whatever single issue that they may have.
I would agree. I'll just begin by saying that all views here are my own and they don't represent where I work. And I just a little caveat. And I would agree. So for me, you hit the nail on the head. I think about the way that we are systematizing and striving to legalize, or not we, but part of society is trying to systematize and legalize human inequality. When I feel like we should be going the other way, we should be systematizing and legalizing equality. And there seems to be such a trenchant resistance to that. And I can't, you know, as someone in the humanities, I can't believe that we can look at a not so distant history and see how over and over again that is just so incredibly harmful to not only human beings, to democracy, to social well-being, to citizenship. So what you said about gender, about immigration, about racial injustice, about LGBTQ plus rights, all those issues, I can't even pinpoint one. So when Alex, you asked what keeps you up at night, many things keep me up at night. And I would agree as well. So that it concerns me that Adventists don't seem more upset about the treatment of other individuals. And in fact, that so many people that I see are embracing this sort of union of church and state when traditionally we have been a church that is more on the end of social justice, even if we've gotten it wrong plenty of times, and definitely on the kind of farther end of keeping a separation of church and state. But I feel like people want, are like, that Christians are looking for some sort of Christian nation, and I think that that is a dangerous and slippery slope.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're bringing up these issues, and it is shocking to me that Adventists aren't more attuned to the way that inequality is structured into our society, in part because we spend so much time thinking about power as it relates to, say, the state or the Catholic Church or Sunday keepers. We're all familiar with that language, and yet we're really silent about the other inequality that's around, at least the kind of majoritarian white church. As we're looking towards this election, I'd love for you to both maybe draw upon your disciplinary interests, the folks that you socialize with, and just give us a perspective on what you're, you know, seeing or hearing as your kind of trying to pierce through the news coverage and try to think about what is going to be the shape of this country in the next 4 years.
Well, just talking from a disciplinary standpoint, as you mentioned, I have kind of two disciplines. So there's ministry and also psychology. From a psychological standpoint, I'm really concerned about people's mental health and well-being, just the re-traumatization of marginalized communities and just the fatigue that I see and the psychological burdens that a lot of people are really subjected to day by day when they are continually, you know, in fear that their rights are going to be taken away in some way, where they're going to continually be marginalized by the institution of the government. And I heard this quote before that says, privilege is when you've never had to have a court decide about your basic rights, you know?
Wow.
And that just really is a privilege that many people have and don't even recognize that, you know, there are lots of people whose basic fundamental right to exist and do the things that other people do is a matter of a legal battle of some kind or a political playing chip, you know? And just the fact that people are continually dealing with the prospect of maybe I might not have the same rights that I have right now in, you know, another year. And that's a very scary thing. And it definitely affects people, just not only psychologically, but also it trickles down into their physical health. And we see just the breakdown and the burden that has on them. And on the flip side, when I'm talking about the ministry piece, you know, Vanessa talked so well about the whole idea of separation in church and state being something that Adventists have always promoted. We have always been at the forefront of religious liberty. And I fear that we have done a lot of, you know, being upset about, like you said, the Roman Catholic Church and all these, and the Sunday laws and all these things that affect us. But we've kind of forgotten the bigger picture of what religious liberty means. Religious liberty is not just liberty for my own self-interest and what I believe, but it's the idea that we have room for everyone and the state should not be legislating religious beliefs for anybody. And I'm afraid that that breakdown of, you know, that interest of our own, you know, superseding everyone else's interest, definitely gets in the way of our message and our evangelism. And I think it also creates rifts inside of our church as different people, you know, square up on different sides of these kinds of issues.
Yeah, Courtney, I don't know if you have a church or what your ministry is, but I want to visit sometime. And I see those rifts, and I think that those rifts speak to one of the disciplinary concerns. Well, actually, both of the disciplinary concerns I have. And I know it's like, well, what does literature have to do with the election? Well, not necessarily literature, but part of what we do in English, we talk a lot about perspective. And being able to, because especially in fiction, what you're asked to do is take on someone else's perspective for X amount of time, however amount of time you're committing to the text. And it is really amazing to me how people cannot or refuse to, maybe it's not even cannot, they choose not to take someone else's perspective. They choose to just be entrenched in their own, and even when presented with facts, when presented with emotional stories, when presented with a wide range of different ways of appealing to the mind and heart, it feels like we're in a time and an era where that entrenchment is so deep that it's really hard to have dialogue and growth because people don't want to let go of their perspectives. Like, I have been in Sabbath school classes where people are making comments about it's okay to have immigrant children in cages because their parents came over here and broke the law. And I've had to say, are you a parent? Like, I mean, as a parent, what would you do for your child? I have a 6-year-old son. I would do anything for my child. So if I were to put my child in danger, it's because I truly felt I had no other choice. That's it. Because there's no way that I'm putting him in danger on purpose. And right. And that people can't for one moment move out of whatever perspective they're getting from the news or from their family members or from whatever and think about someone else is something that I found really challenging, especially as Christians, when we are asked to, right, to think about other people, to do unto others as we would like to be done to ourselves, to be that good Samaritan, right, to think about other people. That is just shocking to me. And I feel like you said it compromises our message. Yes, when we can't look at someone else's perspective, it compromises our message, because how do we even know how to share the good news to the world if we can't see what the world is needing? And I think the other thing that I find really challenging from a disciplinary perspective is the question of the logicality of an argument. So I have friends and colleagues, say, in Sabbath school who are really willing to kind of go staunchly and support the right to life. But I'm like, why does the right to life end with a fetus? Why is this right to life not extended to mothers needing help? Why right. is this not extended to children in cages? Why is this not right to life not extended to every single human being that we ostensibly believe has been created in the image of God? And why does the right to life end when that being comes out of the womb? And why does the life right to life not extend to a mother? And we know the answers to some of these questions, power, gender dynamics, racial dynamics, prejudice. But as Christians, we're called to do better. And that's where I wonder why people can't look at us as Christians and us at Adventists, as Adventists, and see better. Why are they seeing the same toxic messages that they're seeing elsewhere? So great that we are vegan and great that we don't wear jewelry, but really, is that the example we're setting? That it seems not far enough.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. And the whole idea of empathy, I mean, if we're talking about being Christians and emulating the example of Christ, Christ became flesh to dwell among us. You know, the whole incarnation is about Christ, God, becoming human in order to be with us and among us, and that whole idea of relational incarnational ministry. And we ourselves have such a difficult time, just like you said, adopting someone else's perspective, and they're right next to us, you know? I had a conversation with some of my ministerial colleagues just earlier this week about just how you were saying people who don't want to extend the right to life to everyone beyond just in the womb. And even as we talked about third trimester abortions, I don't know if you had seen this interview between Chris Wallace and Pete Buttigieg. And Mayor Pete was just kind of like, you know, when we're talking about third trimester abortions, we're talking about people who want their kid. They've picked out a crib. They have picked out a name, probably. Like, this is a wanted child who, for whatever reason, these women are in this horrible situation where they have to, you know, choose. And this has been made into this huge talking point. And so even that, you know, I'm not even trying to try to gain empathy with my colleagues for people who are having earlier abortions. I'm just the bare minimum. Like, this is a mother who is either dying or their child is not viable. And still, even with the thing that I would think would be baseline humanity and empathy, there were people who were just like, no, not at all. Murder is awful. And even one of our colleagues who is also in ministry had like a very traumatic experience that he had shared about his own experience with this. He and his wife actually had a pregnancy that wound up, they knew that it wasn't going to be viable, but they did not choose to have an abortion. But after the birth, the child suffered for a very brief period of time, less than a day, and, you know, died. And he shared how heartbreaking that was to see and to know that he caused his child pain. And it was just kind of like, you know, had he known then what he knows now, he and his wife would not make that same decision to carry that baby until delivery. Like, that, you know, was horrible and weighs heavily on their heart. And even with that story, there were still people who had the audacity to use words like murderer and just the total opposite of the type of compassion and care that you desire from Christians. And we're not talking about just people in the pews. We're talking about pastors. We're talking about leaders, people who should be at the forefront of showing and telling people, like, you know, this is how we should act. And, you know, so, I mean, if there are people who are like that with a story like that from a colleague of theirs in a situation that is so heart-wrenching for themselves, and that's still the reaction, I hold out very little hope for any sort of compassion when it's somebody that they don't know, someone in the community, someone who is getting an abortion that's early than the third trimester, someone who is in other situations that make that seem like this is what their choices are. You know, I have absolutely no hope, unfortunately, that people will change their mind, unless the one thing that I think does wind up changing people's minds is their own personal experience. Because when it hits home with them, and I definitely do not wish that on anyone.
Yeah.
But I feel like the only time when people often become moved from their very entrenched positions is when it affects them. And now it's not a hypothetical and it's not a story, but now it's their own lived experience. And all of a sudden, all of the objections that they had, you know, well, there's an exception to this, you know, well, it's not exactly the same thing, you know, because that hypothetical has now become reality. And a friend of mine who actually worked at an abortion clinic was telling me how there would be women who she knew who were very pro, you know, they were, you know, pro-life, very vehement in their stance, and they would come in for an abortion. And because there was a meme that someone had written about this on Twitter saying, like, there would be women who would come in and be upset and cussing them out as they're, you know, getting ready for their own procedure, because they themselves, even though they were in a situation where they were choosing to have an abortion, they weren't like those other people. And the people who were the practitioners helping them were, in their mind, people who were, you know, enabling this horrible, horrible thing while they are getting this procedure. And so I had this conversation with my friend where she was like, yeah, this is 100% absolutely true. This has happened when she saw this with her own eyes in the clinic that she worked at. And it's just amazing to me, just the cognitive dissonance that people have, you know, and that's really what it boils down to.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up that point about it really not affecting folks until it affects them personally. I've seen quite a few examples of that. And I would like both of you to kind of maybe reflect on that idea and empathy. How, because both of you dedicate your considerable talents to helping humanity through education and ministry and psychology and attending church, which is its own act of grace. And
absolutely, yeah.
Where did, if you don't mind just speaking personally, can you just reflect back either personally about where your own sense of empathy, you know, expanded in a significant way, or ways that you've seen it expand in a person? I'm feeling a little hopeless right now thinking about the way that our egos really drive our sense of right and wrong. And I'd just like to hear from you where you kind of developed a politics that includes more than just self-interest.
I'm happy to speak to that. I posted about this on my Facebook post a while ago. And I barely ever post on Facebook or anywhere, really. You know, I care really deeply about social justice, but that wasn't always the case because I grew up with all sorts of privilege. So I'm Cuban American, and so you would think that maybe that would mean that I'm a little bit more in tune to like questions of racial or ethnic inequity, and like maybe kind of, but I was really insulated because we are white Cuban Americans. And I grew up for most of my childhood thoroughly middle class, and those in a small town in Central Florida. And so those were really insulating, that was a really insulating environment. And my parents, I think, intentionally tried to keep me insulated and protected, as, you know, Adventist parents can do. And, you know, I left for high school and I went to Forest Lake Academy. And I had been at a diverse junior academy where there were a lot of white and some Hispanic and lots of Asian students. But for the first time, I went to an academy that was even more diverse than that, and where racial prejudice was not hidden. It was just out front and center. Like, someone I remember wanted to wear a Confederate flag on one of our graduation walks because somebody else had wanted to wear a kente cloth. Right. So just out and blatant.
Yeah.
And I say this because I remember that was kind of the beginning of a social justice education that I, A, didn't know I needed, and B, that I'm really grateful for, because it was a lot of labor on other people's parts that I didn't even know to thank them for at the time. And now I do. And sometimes it was just people talking in front of, not to me or at me, but in front of me about really difficult topics. Sometimes it was people sharing really challenging situations that they had been in. And even then, I remember thinking things that embarrass me now, like it's just really, really embarrassing things. So I'll share one, and like, it just is mortifying. It just mortifies me to think of it. But like, oh, well, why do we have to have Black History Month or Hispanic History Month or whatever? Why do we have to have that? Well, I wasn't thinking meta about the fact that every other month is just History Month, which is White History Month, because white people have controlled education and what we get as facts and archives for so long, that I didn't know that because my history teachers weren't having that conversation. And that's total privilege, because I bet you there were other people who didn't look like me and didn't have my background who knew that at a much earlier age than I knew that. And so I can only say, to Courtney's point, that it was my interactions with other people. I think the Holy Spirit is part of that too, because there had to have been some openness there that I can't even take credit for, because it wasn't like I was like, now I'm going to learn about social justice. Like, now I'm going to sit down and read this book. And I know that my ideas and my heart were transformed. And I wouldn't say like, oh, I was such a racist person before, but I was an incredibly ignorant and prejudiced person before. And we're all ignorant and prejudiced people. But now I know that I need to check my ignorance and prejudice, and that I experience less prejudice than other people. And I need to be cognizant of that. And then I need to be willing to give up my power and my privilege to advocate for those people. And it's about really being humble. And there's a lot of work I know that I still need to do, because I think that there's a lot of racial inequity embedded, and we don't even realize it, embedded in how we are taught and in certain Christian messages. There's absolutely prejudice against anyone who is not heterosexual. And I learned all those things sometimes at the foot of my Sabbath school or my pastor. And so it is a constant prayerful attitude of trying to ask Christ to allow me to manifest Christian love and empathy in my life. And it is work. And it is work that you just have to commit to. And it is really painful because you have to check yourself all the time. And then you have to say you're sorry when you mess up. Like, it's not enough to just be like, oh, I'll fix it next time, and then to do better. So I'm not sure that that's like the most inspiring story. But I just want to say that it takes time and work. And all we can do is ask for grace from every single person that we're going to encounter and not get it right, because we won't get it right 100% of the time. And then we continue to be better, because it's really easy to feel like, fine, I give up. Like, I didn't get it perfect, so I'm not going to do it at all. And I think that we just have to be better than that.
100%. I think exactly the part where you said that, you know, we are all ignorant of something, you know, and Alex, you and I have had this conversation on the same podcast?
Yeah.
about, you know, the fact that everyone has blind spots and everyone has something that they were unaware of before, and we all have them to grow. And just a personal experience of mine, you know, I grew up in New York City, and we're a very diverse city. And obviously there's lots of people who are here who are immigrants from other countries. And even in my church that I grew up in, we had a lot of people who immigrated here, but a lot of those people had green cards, or at least when they talked about their immigration story, it was, you know, how I got this green card and how I came here, or I came on a visa or something like that. And I remember, you know, not necessarily being prejudiced towards people who were immigrants, but more so like having the thought, like, if these people that I know could come to the United States, quote unquote, the right way, you know, and they didn't get to the front of the line, then everybody should just go the right way, quote unquote, and they should not try to get in the front and not try to cut the line and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And yeah, if you're here and you got here the wrong way, then you shouldn't be rewarded for that kind of a thing. And I remember when I was teaching, at one of our academies, I was a chaplain and a religion teacher. I was teaching my senior religion class, and some of the kids there were talking about, you know, what are they going to do after graduation and all this other kind of stuff. And I had a really smart student who just didn't say anything. And I was like, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to go to college? What are you going to do? And, you know, he's like, oh, probably not. And, you know, I took the side later on and I'm like, well, you know, what's going on? Why wouldn't you want to continue your education? And he was just kind of like, because I can't. And this was actually before, this is before Obama was president, this is before DACA, is for all, and he had been brought here as a child, and he didn't have, you know, documentation. And so he was just like, yeah, I'm not going to be able to go to college, and, you know, I'm going to probably wind up just working. And I'm just like, how is this a thing? And it wasn't until I had that personal experience with someone that I connected to that I was just like, huh, you know, this person is a person who I think is a great person, and his family is a good family. So what's going on here? And that's when I actually took the time to educate myself about what really are the obstacles and what really is the process and how cumbersome it is. And, you know, how unfair in many cases it is, and how long people actually wait, and how many hoops that we make people jump through, even people who are seeking asylum, which is legal for people to do. And it just boggled my mind, and it just transformed my entire thought process around, you know, the whole immigration process. And I think it's very easy for any of us to get caught up in what we think a process is, or what we think a certain group of people are like, or what we believe about a certain topic that we have heard a lot about. But unless we really have an incentive to take the time to investigate and to study it for ourselves, we're only hearing half the story. We're only hearing part of whatever it is that we think we know. And more than likely, we're going to only consume that information that only reinforces our belief. And for me, that belief was people who want to immigrate here have a process. They can go through the process. Why don't people go through the process? And the idea that, oh, wait, maybe there's something else that I don't know about this never even occurred to me, you know, until I had this confrontation with someone in my real life. And I think that that happens all the time. And that is probably one of the key reasons why people don't really have that change of heart, or even a willingness to change their mind until it happens to them, because they really don't have any reason nor incentive to just go and make this, you know, investigation themselves. And so now it's sort of the opposite. Now I volunteer for Physicians for Human Rights, and I do pro bono work for people who are refugees and asylum seekers who need to be able to pass psychological evaluations, or at least have psychological evaluations. It's not a pass or fail, but they need to have an evaluation conducted. And so I am able to help those people to get those evaluations, because there's a backlog of people, like years long. There are some people that I see who have been waiting for an immigration trial for like a decade or more. And it's crazy to me, but there's just not enough people to help them move through the system efficiently. And our system is pretty jacked up. So that whole concept of, wow, we need to really understand all perspectives probably isn't something that most of us actively seek out unless we need to, or unless we have to, because we are left with no other choice.
Yeah. Thank you to both of you for being so open and honest about your own journeys there, and sharing some really poignant anecdotes. I am worried, though, that that folks don't get enough opportunities to really get their perspective changed. And so, kind of wrapping up, my last question is, what gives you hope in a world right now where people aren't interacting enough and listening enough to each other? The election is coming soon. it's not going to change everything. Maybe it will change a few things for the better. Whatever happens, I think I need hope. So how can you give us some hope?
Well, I would say that my students give me hope, and that sounds super cheesy and corny, but it's just true. They are amazing human beings, and they dialogue with each other and with their parents, and I think they give me hope for a future and for whatever generations before us haven't completed, whatever my generation isn't getting done, theirs is coming. And I find that really hopeful. And then I also think, you know, I've mentioned my Sabbath school several times, but it gives me hope. It's intergenerational, it's intercultural. And we have people on the quote unquote more liberal spectrum and then quote unquote more conservative. And we meet every week and talk and have difficult conversations. And it's not easy. And sometimes people get mad. And yet we are there and we treat each other with grace and kindness. And I think that bravery for us to say what we need to say and to speak truth to each other and to challenge each other is really important, because both, and I hate these binary terms, but both left and right, both conservatives and liberals, whether we're talking about conservative Adventists or liberal Adventists, or whether we're talking conservative and liberal when it comes to politics, tend to just silo themselves off because it is really painful to be exposed to things that challenge you and hurt you. And sometimes things aren't a challenge. Sometimes things are just wrong. But nevertheless, we have to be able to be brave enough to dialogue, because if not, you just end up talking to an echo chamber. And I've seen a lot of growth and change in my Sabbath school, and I think that gives me hope.
I let out a little yay when you said your students give you hope, because I really do echo the same thing. Shameless plug for the Society for Black Neuropsychology. We do a lot of events geared towards undergrad students and grad students, and trying to help just our next generation be successful in the field of psychology and neuropsychology in particular, but just in education in general. And we're open to people from all backgrounds. And one of the things that is really cool, we just had an event earlier this week, and so many people from so many different backgrounds, so many undergrad students were a part of that. And it was really beautiful to see just how many young people are committed to making our world a better place. Again, like you said, Vanessa, it sounds so cheesy, but I mean, it is the truth. That's exactly what it is. It's the idea that we have this future generation that really is trying to see a perspective that maybe previous generations were unwilling to see or unable to see because of the way that they grew up or not having the opportunity or being isolated, because our world is becoming more global. And just the fact is, we're going to be interacting with more people more and more, even though many of us are still in isolation from COVID. We still have this society where we rub shoulders with each other, and it becomes so much harder to just stay in your neat little bubble. You still can. There's still places, there's still pockets where you can just be insulated. But more and more, our just society is so much a melting pot. Well, not even a melting pot, a salad bowl, where you have so many different people just coming together. And those experiences, especially for our young people, help to shape their minds and shape them in a way where they're just a lot more open to being people who advocate for equality for other people, and really are not afraid to speak out when something is not okay. And I am so enthusiastic, and that is what gives me the most hope out of all of this.
Well, it's been encouraging to talk with both of you and I really learned a lot from your perspectives, and you have given me hope. Thank you so much for being willing to lead in our Adventist community and to think out loud in the many ways that you do. So thanks so much for having this conversation.
Yes, I do, Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move with the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely.
I'll never forget.